I'm Christine Moutier, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, which is the leading nonprofit organization fighting suicide in the U.S.
You may remember a couple of months ago, we talked with Raman Tabatabai, who's the Associate Residency Director at USC, about a classmate of his, Tony, who soon after residency committed suicide. It was a shock to all of us, because we had no idea. And then it turns out that when you ask residents, a significant portion have active suicidal thoughts. And not just residents, it turns out, but physicians and healthcare workers in general. So that's why we brought in an expert. Just how big is this issue?
10 to 12% of medical students, trainees, practicing physicians, if you were to survey a group of 1,000 of them at any given time, anywhere, that number of them, 10 to 12%, will be having suicidal thoughts. That's maybe a bit more than the general population age matched. But when you have a profession that has historically really kind of discriminated against those aspects of getting help for those experiences, that's, I think, where the rub comes. And we're just as a profession really getting smarter about that.
Because when the team at USC asked our residents, nearly 40 of our residents, how many were having suicidal ideation, the number was almost exactly right there.
That is normal, that is expected, but is it acceptable? No way. We have to destigmatize, open up the dialogue, and allow people to get help that they need in a smarter way.
Because in medicine, it's physician, heal thyself. Within emergency medicine, there's this whole thing about how cowboy we are, how tough, how nothing can stop us. And it's a fallacy. In fact, there is data out there that physicians are much more likely to have suicidal thoughts and to complete suicide because of their knowledge and access to medications.
That is true overall. The data is a little tricky around suicide rates because data collection across the country, state by state, county by county, and then by occupation in particular, it's not real time, and it's sometimes population-based, and it's sometimes cohort-based, following a cohort over time. But what I will say is the best we have is Eva Schoenhammer in Boston took a look at all of the big studies of physician suicide and found that the rate of suicide for male and female physicians across the board, internationally and in the U.S., is higher than their age-matched population in general. So with female physicians having an even exaggeratedly higher rate or higher risk than non-physician females, about 2.27 times higher the rate than non-physician females, whereas males is about 1.4 times the rate than non-physician males.
So can we finally dispel this myth? Yeah, you're smart. Yeah, you got in med school. Yeah, you achieved at a really high level. But you're at higher risk than people just like you who are not in the medical profession. And in fact, if you're a woman, your risk is astoundingly higher. We are human. In this case, astoundingly human.
Why is it the rate so much higher? Is it because we are pushing people in this profession to being more suicidal, or are we just uncovering underlying depression that may be at a higher rate in people that choose this profession?
That's Matt DeKlerk. He's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at USC and another one of Tony's classmates.
This is, I think, a really, really great question and something that we do have some answers to that aren't, I think, that intuitive to folks. So if you'll just indulge me for a moment, you kind of have to understand what drives suicide risk, period, before we can really talk about physician suicide risk. And so, yes, stress, cultural beliefs, and the environment does matter a lot when it comes to population rates of suicide. But to just look at one thing or the other doesn't do the whole picture justice. So suicide is, what the research really clearly shows, is that suicides occur when multiple risk factors pile up on top of each other. And a sort of necessary but insufficient aspect of that pile up are changes in mental health. Whether it has been recognized, oftentimes that's not the case. Person may have fallen into a depression, an anxiety, a PTSD, substance abuse, and oftentimes multiple things, along with physical health problems, oftentimes. And, you know, in our society, we get stressed and we look to those external events happening and we don't always think, has this become a health issue for me that I can now manage and address through multiple modalities, including self-management stuff, treatment, garnering the supports around me. So I say all that just to say that whenever the topic of physician suicide comes up, people will say, really? You know, why is that? Oh, it's the stress they face, right? It's those life and death situations. And 100%, we face stressful situations, but so does everybody and so does every occupation. So what we know from prevention science as well is that getting treatment can make a world of difference. And when you're in an environment that doesn't encourage that and might even punish people in a way, in a weird way, for getting treatment, that really augments risk.
I mean, it seems like such a huge disconnect. When you think about medicine, you think about people taking care of illnesses and diseases. And if we have patients that are depressed, et cetera, we are there to help them. Why is such a big disconnect when it comes to, well, helping ourselves or helping our colleagues? What's that barrier?
We can look at a bunch of things about the barriers to help seeking as physicians. But, you know, there's a lot of practical aspects to that. Who has the time? Is this really an issue that is health related, or is this just a passing circumstance of my life? So there's a lot of denial that we use in society. And then as physicians, I have thought a lot about the fact that we sort of self-select into a profession where we have to work a little harder than the rest. We're driven. We want to become leaders, healers, you know, whatever that means to us. Something drives us pretty darn hard. And so our sense of ourselves, our identity as physicians by the time we're in training and beyond, I think we have our own kind of self-stigma. And that's true of the human race, by the way. But I think that may be especially true when you've got a lot at stake that you've worked towards to establish your reputation and your identity as a physician. And then again, there are some practical things that in the past and to some extent the present, if you check the box on a medical licensing form that says, I've been depressed, I've sought treatment for depression, you might have invited an automatic investigation into your competency or into the history of your treatment records, which isn't necessarily legal or okay. And those things, I'm happy to say, are undergoing change right now. But, you know, those are some of the factors at play.
And it's on every application that you've had the joy of filling out. You go for a new ER job and it'll ask you a whole series of things that are basically irrelevant, but include, you know, have you been depressed? Have you been suicidal? Have you drunk too much because you had a bad case? Have you sought help for your depression and your suicidal thoughts? And the answer is, oh yeah, damn straight. But there's no way I'm ticking that box, thank you very much, because I have no idea what that's going to trigger. What are you going to do with the information? Am I going to get the job? Because it turns out I kind of need to eat and I'm perfectly functional right now, thank you very much. When I had my own bout with the demons, I went and saw a therapist. I went and sought help. And the first thing that therapist said was, Mel, how are you going to pay for this? Do you want to go through your insurance? Because I find that most doctors don't want to do that because they don't want there to be a record. Or do you want to pay cash? I paid cash. We've created this absurd problem for ourselves, but thankfully, there is some movement to change this. So how did we get here? And what do we do?
Well, if you look at it from a big picture standpoint, it wasn't until several decades ago that we really had good, solid information about the neuroscience behind mental health conditions. So they were highly stigmatized. People who were depressed, psychotic, anxious, and more, you know, were relegated to moral, spiritual, characterological flaws. And that thread of sort of stigma and societal view of mental health problems is remaining today in many different ways. And so if you think about the role of state medical boards, basically to license and regulate the profession of medicine within each state in the United States. And so I think one of their primary responsibilities, and correctly so, is to protect the public. And there had been, I believe, a very erroneous assumption that if a person has a mental health condition, that equates to impairment and problems with competency in safe and competent practice. And if you now collect all the science up around psychiatric conditions and look at that side by side with the science around physical medical conditions, I think there's a lot of important sort of comparisons to be made, we would not have that same assumption about physicians who have hypertension, diabetes, or
cancer,
other,
or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And so the same thing, that you're so right. So many physicians live with and manage well their mental health and their mental health conditions.
So am I the only one? Am I the only one that may have told a fib on one of those forms that I had to fill out through the many years of going to different hospitals in different countries, trying to get a job, you know, to feed said family?
Another thing you said about physicians lie on those forms, that is 100% true. Katie Gold just published a study of over 2,000 female physicians who all happened to be mothers. I mean, she selected a group. It was a convenient sample through Facebook. And one of the questions she asked was, since the time of graduating medical school, have you likely experienced mental health symptoms and struggles that probably met criteria for a mental health condition? And it was a very high percentage of the group who had, and a very low percentage who had actually sought help. And of those who had sought help, 6% said that they had disclosed that on medical licensing forms. So, you know, I think there are two arguments to be made to the state medical boards, and I'm happy to say that they're listening at this point in history. Mental health conditions do not equate to impairment, and there are probably better ways to protect the public and to try to screen for those unsafe practice and competency problems, because the current system, this is the other point, doesn't work. We're not finding those problems, and in fact, we've unintentionally driven the problem far, far into a spiraled out worse place, because people either lie on the forms, or worse, they don't seek treatment. They take them underground. They self-medicate.
And that, of course, is the real problem. If as a profession we're afraid to disclose, to talk about, to get help for some of these issues, then what do?
It seems like such a paradox that the worse we feel, the more depressed we feel, the less likely we are to seek treatment and physicians, and the more likely we are to self-medicate. And we don't do that with other conditions. If my blood sugar was way wacky, out of control, I'd get on a medication. Yet there's a disconnect, and I don't know how we can remedy that. It seems like we're at a crossroads right now where we could get to a place where, if the numbers are as high as you say, potentially 10% of us are having suicidal thoughts at any given point, does that mean we should be screening at all points and providing sort of even mandatory mental health access points for people if the numbers are that high?
I think we have a lot of work to do before we talk about mandatory screening, because right now there's great distrust of our colleagues, our leaders, our residency training program directors. If we're screening everybody and they're not even sure what you do with that information, that you're coming from a supportive place, then I think that's kind of just jumping the gun in terms of order of operations here. You know, I think the key thing is that if a message is given to every medical student and every trainee and beyond, you know, if you're a hospital CEO, then to every one of your staff physicians, that human issues are expected, mental health struggles happen, and there's no shame in getting the help that you need to keep yourself well, if at all possible, and to keep practicing. But then you have to live that out, and you have to show them that those words mean something in terms of the policies and procedures that are in place.
Now, there is some hope here, right? Because just a few years ago, if you as a physician, particularly as an ER doc, said to somebody, "I'm feeling burnt out," that was a sign of weakness. We didn't talk about that. That was not part of what you did. Now we know through published reports that we're burnt out, that this job is hard, and that of all physicians, yay, we're number one. We're the most burnt out of a group of people that's pretty burnt out. But there's no stigma to that now. You can go into a room with colleagues and saying, "I'm fried," and get some support for that and get a little time off and do what you need to do to get renewed. It's accepted because it's normalized. We all know now that it's common. It's part of the job. And so the hope is that maybe we can move the needle when it comes to sort of mental health in general within our profession.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's happening in the general public with regard to attitudes towards mental health. My organization, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, conducted a Harris poll of the general population and found that 90% of people, and trending with younger groups of Americans especially, but overall 90% view mental health as equally important to physical health. valid and legit, and lots of other attitudes that I think if we had done the survey 5 or 10 years ago would have looked actually quite different. So I think something is happening. There is sort of a tipping point that's being reached. And as that younger generation grows up, these issues are becoming normalized. Now, we never want to normalize suicide, though. Suicide should remain a tragic, preventable, premature loss of life. But the struggles that precede it are common to humankind. So that part of it, you know, now how that trickles into medical environments is a really interesting story. It's happening local places sort of case by case because people have become educated, maybe even sort of passionate and advocating. Maybe they're a leader and they're willing to start telling their own story in appropriate ways, but really role modeling that these are issues we can all face and deal with well. Whether it's a one-time thing or whether it's ongoing kind of management of a chronic health issue. So lots of changes happening with regard to the conversations and people's ability to talk about this openly without stigma and shame.
Raman asked the question, is there a profile or is there a set of signs and symptoms that we can look at and say, okay, I've got a colleague that's in trouble? It's important. And Matt follows up with this.
I mean, I think the biggest thing for me was my first 2 years out, I not only lost Tony from residency, but had, you know, a colleague at my first job who was most outgoing person, super friendly, 2 young children, and same thing, committed suicide, totally surprised everybody. And for me, that was the trigger because we had talked about Tony and then this happened again. I'm like, if that's out there, like, well, am I going to commit suicide? Is someone, you know, one of my other colleagues, is this just something that comes out of the blue? How do you find and approach that trigger?
I think back to the question, too, about what's going on with physicians in particular. And, you know, among the suicides that are occurring in our nation and in the world every day, and there's 121 suicides every day in the U.S. that occur.
Let me just stop for a second. Did you hear that? There are more suicide deaths in the United States than there is car accidents or death by gunshot wounds. More than both of those. That was a stunning statistic to me.
And some percentage of those are people who were exceedingly good at keeping their distress and what was going on internally completely under wraps and kind of putting a face out to their colleagues, maybe even their family members, that said, I'm okay, because they were protecting themselves in some way that they, you know, felt was necessary at that point in time. I think we as physicians have been trained in many ways, and again, maybe not as much in the current day, but historically, to really put on that white coat and put on the face of the professional. Of course, we should do that. But with each other, we have to have each other's backs. We have to be able to process the stuff that's really bothering us and going on, whether it's in the workplace or other stuff in life. The ability to process through stress and conflict and really weird moments that struck you funny during the day, during the workday, if you have no place to go over that with somebody, whether it's a mentor, a therapist, a family member, that is a problem, because then there's a whole buildup that happens. And if you're somebody who happens to have any mental health vulnerability, some people are really lucky. They're very, very robust genetically, and early childhood influences and lack of ACEs, early childhood adversity, lack of exposure to other things that put people at risk for suicide. But this is what I'm talking about, the pileup. A lot of these risk factors are very invisible and in the background. So to answer your question, when you have that experience of losing somebody to suicide, there is often this feeling of being completely blindsided and sideswiped. And you go back over every interaction and you think through, was that an indicator? Had something shifted then for them? And was that a sign that they were starting to be distressed and become overwhelmed and hopeless? And those are actually important kind of hindsight, the big why question that suicide loss survivors do. But I think what we need to do moving forward is, if we can, just again, as we were talking about earlier, open up this dialogue so that, not inappropriately, not necessarily publicly, but with particularly trusted individuals in your life. And ideally, that includes some colleagues or some mentors in your professional life, that you can actually tell them the real deal of what's going on. That is actually very highly professional and protective of people to learn how to do that. And that should be a safe thing that we allow ourselves to do in our profession.
All right, let's start wrapping up this conversation for now. For now. So step one. Start talking to people. Start asking people how they're doing. You, the colleague, is the single most important resource. You have a shared experience. Ask your friends that are docs, how are they doing? Are they worried about themselves? It's okay to talk about it. So at an institutional level, at a residency level, at a university level, at a private group level, what are the things that we've got to change to get a handle on this thing?
In the environment, I would say there are a few very key changes that must happen to send the message effectively, because we can use words about this, but it's not going to work unless there are follow-through on it. And this is might seem like a bit of a tangent, but I actually think that when you hear about or you work in an environment that's really full of and prone to toxic behaviors that don't get addressed, I'm talking about workplace bullying, slurs that particular minority groups might feel, and others just sort of like may or may not notice it. Some may cringe, but you have that bystander experience of just sort of staying silent. That kind of workplace environment sends a very powerful and clear message to anyone who's struggling on any level with anything that this is not a safe place to air your concerns with. So I think it actually starts, even though that sounds like a very broad sweeping thing, but to start creating environments where they're just respectful and safer environments, period. And that will at least create a platform then where those messages around self-care, supporting each other when it comes to our own mental health, can actually be received with legitimacy.
So that's take-home point number two for me. Enough already. You know, the macho, we're really tough and we talk down to each other and we scream at each other. Those days are over. They're gone. That's the kind of experience that I had during residency. Not just from attendings, but from colleagues and from surgical residents and deans of medical schools. It was toxic, but it was considered tough and strong, and it made you a man and a woman in medicine. No, it didn't. It made you depressed. It put you at risk. Enough of that. I'm not saying that we don't need to be pulled aside every now and then and be told we're screwing up. It's not what I'm talking about. It's about how you do it. Okay, so what about at an institutional level? What can we do?
What we were doing at UCSD, and they're still doing there, with their suicide prevention and wellness program, that, by the way, is for the entire population, faculty, trainees, med students, and now it's actually just been expanded to the entire hospital staff. Very, very cool. But part of that program was a very massive educational campaign that tried to and tries to teach people, what do you do if you notice the sign of distress going on in a colleague? Like, we've been so hesitant to speak up and say something because we don't want to offend people. We don't want to make them feel like they're being called out. And really, we're doing it from a place of caring, but we haven't had the words to use. So some training around that is really important. And I mean, for me, this is just really basic. This is like, invite them to coffee and say, I've noticed X, Y, and Z. Be very direct. I'm coming from a place of wanting to support you and caring about you purely. How are you doing? And really just open-ended, let them talk. If you do that and they do start talking, you will probably hear some of that internal stuff. We were talking earlier about that disconnect between internal distress and the face that we present to the world. And again, in a safe place and time, you can be that colleague who actually gives them an opportunity to talk about what's going for real on the inside. And as odd as it sounds, even, you know, professional mental health treatment aside, and very important as it is, that peer-to-peer connection or just human-to-human connection is incredibly powerful. And especially if the person can handle it, doesn't freak out, you know, is a trustworthy person who even maybe asks you a few days or whatever's appropriate in terms of the information they've shared, but circles back around and says, hey, how are you doing with that thing?
I mean, you mentioned the normalization part of it. And I don't know, personally, that strikes a note because I was dealing with a lot of burnout after those events in my first few years out. And I remember, you know, just internalizing and it just stressing me out. And one of those stressors was, for me, was the barriers I put, like, well, what am I going to tell my parents, my peers, my mentors? And, you know, it took a lot of pushing from my wife, thank God. But finally, when I even talked to my mentors, they were super supportive. Whereas in my mind, I was like, oh, they're going to think I'm a failure, et cetera. And it was really liberating just to know that, oh, yeah, it is normal. They're going through it too. And they don't think I'm a failure. If anything, they're like, good for you. And So I think, you know, as a message that in terms of that normalization, people should just realize, hey, you only live once and just do what you've got to do, and people aren't going to be as judgy as you think.
Yeah, and those messages can come from very official places and points in time when you're entering residency or whatever, and that's important. But then hearing it, kind of the word on the street from peers, that that's really what people, how they think they would do for themselves, that takes it the full nine yards then. And that's a sign that an institution or a program has now matured into a place of not just starting with this, but it's become genuine and embraced by the individuals themselves.
Look, we're going to talk a lot more about this. We're going to continue to talk about it. We're going to do a live event on it. But take away some of those take-home points. Stress in this job is ubiquitous. Suicidal thought is incredibly common. Suicide itself, tragically common. If you're feeling it, start talking to somebody. If you've got a colleague you're worried about, start talking to them. That is the single most powerful thing that you can do. It turns out that actually, in studies at UCSD, for example, they were able to significantly reduce the number of suicides following that program. This is a preventable disease, and we can be part of the solution.